Boom. Test. Test. Okay. And here. And too many buttons. There we go. And this. All right. And recording. Okay. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam, Sarva Bhuta Guhashayam, Yat Sarva Vishayatitam, Tasmai Shubhavde Namaha. Oh my, very good. Welcome to you all. We continue our study. Now, this is recording, I hope. And this is recording. We had problems before. We have all new setup here in our small hall. Anything new will have bugs, as they say. What an interesting term, bugs. Anyway, welcome to you all. Welcome also to the many students who attend these classes online. Last week, let me mention for you, last week we had to cancel classes. Most of you know I have a problem with vertigo, dizziness, and sometimes I'm just too dizzy to teach. So I request that before you come to any class, check your email for a last-minute cancellation notice. That way I know, I can let you know, I can tell you at last. If I wake up feeling like that, what can I do? So please check your email. And of course, if you're not already signed up for our program announcement emails, that's a very good idea. Okay, in our last class, we finished chapter 14. Each of these chapters are completely independent, which means if you're coming today for the first time, this is the right time to come. We're starting a new chapter. Every chapter being independent is not connected to what came before, so you'll be perfectly fine. But before we begin chapter 15, there's one question that came with regard to chapter 14. This is a question from Nita, who asks, what happens to a person who is enlightened but doesn't do nididhyasana and dies with a lack of assimilation? Most of you know that nididhyasana is Vedanta contemplation, which is meant to make your all of your thinking conform to what you know. So often, what we know and the way our minds work are so different, we need to close that gap. It's really a gap between experience and knowledge, which is a huge topic. We don't want to go into that. But presuming that you get this idea, let's understand the purpose of Advaita Vedanta is to remove suffering. Now, there are two aspects to that removal of suffering. One is removal of suffering here and now, in this lifetime. And the second is the removal of any possible future suffering. So therefore, that's where we come to this doctrine that the enlightened person is free from rebirth. Now, just to give you some technical terms, which will make this really clear, according to the doctrine of karma, There is such a thing as a drishtapala and adrishtapala. Drishtapala is a pala here in the sense of result. A result which is drishta, seen, experienced here and now. And then there is adrishtapala, results which are not seen and experienced now, but rather at some later date. And a classic example for that is when you do some rituals like yajna, offering ghee into a sacred fire. The adrishtapala is that you receive some punya, which may bless you in later in this life or some future life. There's also drishtapala for that yajna. What is a drishtapala? Ashes, right? So, taking that metaphor and applying it here, this self-inquiry using the teachings of Vedanta has drishtapala and adrishtapala. Adrishtapala, that which is not experienced now, is freedom from rebirth. Drishtapala is freedom from suffering here and now. So the question is, what happens to a person who is enlightened but dies without doing nididhyasana? The absence of nididhyasana may prevent that person from enjoying the fruits of these teachings here and now in this lifetime. So they, by not doing nididhyasana, that person may miss out on the drishtapala, the immediate effect, but that person certainly will not be deprived of the adrishtapala if he or she is truly enlightened. So that's the idea. Please note that the focus of Sri Shankara is primarily on the drishtapala. Why? Because how do we know what happens after we die? No one knows. So it's much more pragmatic to focus on here and now. And that certainly is the spirit of Sri Shankaracharya. Okay, that's enough. Let us, what do we have to do here? The title of our chapter is, this is chapter 15, Nanyat Anyat Prakarana. Prakarana just means chapter. Nanyat Anyat, this is, we've seen this in several previous chapters, are simply the first words of the first verse. So they don't have any special meaning, global meaning for the chapter, but we'll discuss those words in detail in just a few minutes when we get to the first verse, which is right now. I'll just mention in passing that the chapters in this text are mostly arranged in terms of increasing size. Every later chapter is longer than the prior one. Chapter 18, if I remember, is some 300 verses long, and I think we may study that one in summary rather than verse by verse. And then the final chapter, 19, goes back to being short. Anyway, so this chapter is some 50 verses long, so in the middle. The early chapters were very short, and that chapter 18 is huge, so we will just keep that in mind as we continue. So here's the very first verse of the of chapter 15, and as always, as I'm chanting, read the English translation and then repeat after me. Nanyaranyat bhavet yasman, nanyaranyat bhavet yasman, nanyat kinchit vichintayet, nanyat kinchit vichintayet, anyasyanyat svabhavehi anyasyanyatvahyavehi nashasthasya dhruvo bhavet nashasthasya dhruvo bhavet. It's just a funny metaphor. In filmmaking, they say the opening part of your film has to be so arresting. This is also true for people who publish on YouTube. The opening has to really be powerful and capture your attention. Otherwise, nowadays you just click and that's gone. But I guess the connection here is that Shankara opens this with an amazing verse, a very powerful verse, and actually I'll make further comments about this verse after we've seen it. So this is, an unusual verse. It stands out for its profundity. It's also a little obscure if you just look at the Sanskrit. He says, na anyat bhavet anyat. Na anyat anyat bhavet. Anyat means another thing. And he says, literal translation is one thing cannot become another. One thing cannot become another. And of course, we're studying Advaita Vedanta, so the second anyat refers to jiva, the limited individual. The first anyat refers to Brahman, absolute reality. And what he's saying then is jiva cannot become Brahman. Huh? I thought that's what we're... many people think that is the goal, to undergo a process of inner transformation whereby the limited individual being sheds its limitations and becomes non-separate with Brahman. Doesn't work like that. Can't work like that. Consider this. The teachings of Advaita Vedanta are teachings, words. Can any kind of teaching, let's call it this. Let's say that my act of teaching is a karma, which is absolutely correct. Teaching is karma. Writing a text like Shankara's Upadesha Sahasri, karma. Now here's a question. A principle. The result of any karma is proportional to the karma. For a small karma, small result. Big karma, big result. What kind of result is becoming Brahman? Small, big, off the charts, so to speak. Infinite. So if our goal is infinite, off the charts, what kind of effort, what kind of karma would be required to get there? This is really important. And this is why many people complain about all this stuff. This Advaita Vedanta is so technical. What I just taught you was technical. But you see how important it is? It's highly technical. But it's crucial to understand this fundamental principle in spiritual life in general, and Advaita Vedanta in particular. And that principle is karma cannot make you enlightened. No karma can make you enlightened. Is meditation karma? Yep. Can't make you enlightened. Is bhakti, prayer, devotion, karma? Yeah. Includes much more than that, but it is karma. How, karma yoga, obviously. Karma. About Hatha Yoga. Stand on your head. That'll make you enlightened. Make me dizzy. Anyway. And this is the importance of this initial teaching. If the goal is infinite, it cannot be reached through karma. Now, before we move on, please don't misunderstand me. I didn't mean to imply that bhakti and karma yoga and meditation are useless. Those of you who have been attending these classes, you know very well, all of these are required to allow these teachings to become fully effective. So they're like prerequisites. They enable you. They don't directly produce enlightenment. We can say indirectly. I'll spare you the Sanskrit words for all of that. So, no karma can make you, can transform you into Brahman. You do not become Brahman. In fact, the state of becoming is often called samsara. Because if you have to undergo change, then you have to undergo more change, and more change, and more change. When will that process of undergoing change or transformation end? There's a metaphor from science that I've given before. Suppose you have a process that removes 90% of the impurity from water. So you put it through your process, and it is now 90% pure. Of course, you want pure water, so you put it through again. Then how pure is it? I think 99% pure. Then you put it through again. How pure is it? 99.9% pure. How many times do you have to put it through that process in order to have perfectly pure water? That just illustrates, even in science, a state of perfection cannot be reached through finite means, karma. Okay, enough said. And that's how Shankara begins this text by saying that one thing cannot be, literally he says, one thing cannot become another. But in this context, what he is teaching us is the limited individual being we call Jiva cannot become Brahman. One thing cannot become a Brahman. Jiva cannot become Brahman. And second line, he continues this thought. In fact, a consequence of this is, therefore, anyat na kinchit chintayet. Therefore, you shouldn't consider na chintayet, you shouldn't consider kinchit anything to be anyat. An enlightened person is one who understands, who realizes, who gets it. All this is Brahman. There is only Brahman. There is nothing else. Na anyat. Nothing other than Brahman. This is a vision of an enlightened person. So as long as you're thinking Brahman is other, you're trapped. If you think Brahman is out there, you have to find it, you have to gain it, you have to reach it. That very conclusion is an obstacle to enlightenment. Your spiritual search is based on a wrong conclusion. It's like, you know, in your car, most people have this GPS nowadays. So you're driving to your destination. If you put in the wrong destination, will you arrive where you want to? Never. So if your concept of the goal is incorrect, your pursuit will be incorrect. So that's what he's saying here. Therefore, thinking you should literally, he says, you not, actually to put Brahman back into his language, you should not consider the goal, Brahman, to be something other than what you already are. This is the only solution. And the only solution, if you can't become Brahman, and yet the enlightened ones say, you are Brahman. So you're thinking, I'm not Brahman. And the enlightened person says, no, your essential nature is Brahman. The only possible solution, since you can't become Brahman for the reasons we just discussed, you must already be Brahman, but you don't know it. That's it. It's very simple. This is one of the central teachings of Advaita. That is, my guru's words are so nice. You already are what you want to become. You already have what you want to possess. Very nice. And that is a truth. Now, when you consider that, no, how can I be already Brahman if you reject that idea and you, as I said before, if you now continue your spiritual journey based on a wrong assumption, you're not going to be successful. And there's a secondary thing that Shankara is referring to here, perhaps a little bit obliquely. Especially in Shankaracharya's time, there was a common notion that whatever you meditate upon, you gain those qualities. So if you want to be, this is not quite modern thinking, but it was thinking of Shankaracharya's time. If you want to become brilliant, meditate on the sun. If you want to be calm or beautiful, meditate on the moon. If you want to be powerful, meditate on Indra. Anyway, they had this thought that by meditating on something, you acquire those qualities. So, and that carried over, that many people felt, by meditating on Brahman, you become Brahman. But as we just said, meditation is karma. Karma is finite. How can your finite karma make you identical to Brahman? You already are Brahman. And let me point it out right now so I don't forget. This, actually, let me finish the verse. So in the second half, he gives a second argument for why one thing cannot become another, why Jiva cannot become or be transformed into Brahman. The second argument is anyasya anyatva bhavehi, he, because if anyasya, for one thing, if anyatva bhave, if it attains another state, and again, the language is very obscure, I'll make it clear in just a moment, then what? Nashaha tasya dhruvaha bhavet. Then dhruvaha, certainly, nashaha bhavet, destruction would occur, tasya, for that. It's very, without a concrete example, it doesn't seem very meaningful, but the most common example that's given by the commentator and by just in the tradition of Advaita Vedanta is the transformation of milk into curds. This dahi, you call it. So dagdha is what's milked from the cow. It becomes dahi. It becomes yogurt. When milk becomes yogurt, what happens to the milk? When you're done, do you have any milk? Milk is gone. The milk is destroyed, so to speak, in that process of transformation. Milk ceases to become milk. The essence of milk is gone. Milk is milk. I don't have to tell you what milk is. So here's the metaphor. In any process of transformation, the prior state of existence goes away. That's what he's saying here. Now the Sanskrit might make a little more sense. Again, it's a little abstract. Anyasya, for something else, like milk, anyatva bhave, if it becomes something else, like yogurt, then what is the consequence? Tasya, for that other thing, for that milk, nashaha dhruvaha bhavet, it is certainly destroyed. So Shankara here gives a second argument for why you don't become Brahman, why you can't become Brahman, or to use other words, why you're already Brahman. Now, this is a very, I find this an unusual verse, unusually powerful verse. And what's a little surprising is as we continue with the opening verses of this chapter, what he talks about doesn't seem to be related to this first verse. He starts talking about other things immediately with the second verse, which we'll see in just a moment. So, this verse, properly understood, in Sanskrit we call it a pratignya. In logic, pratignya is what you want to prove, that which is going to be proved. In science, I think it would be like a hypothesis, that which you want to test, that which you want to prove. So here, this verse is like a hypothesis. Better to call it what it is. It is a pratignya, an opening statement of truth, which is going to be examined and proved in the following text. And really speaking, the remainder of this text, you know, the remainder of this chapter is presented by Sri Shankara to establish the truth of this first verse. So keep it in mind as a pratignya, because you won't see any flow of thought between verse 1 and 2. 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. flow very nicely. But from verse 1 to verse 2, it's very abrupt, because this is this hypothesis being stated. This is the pratignya. Okay, so let us continue. Smarato drishyate drishtam, smarato drishyate drishtam, pate chit. Trami varpitam, pate chitrami varpitam, yatraye na chatau gneyao, yatraye na chatau gneyao, satvakshetragnya sangyakao, satvakshetragnya sangyakao. Oh, I forgot to mention, if you're interested, these slides are available on our website. Some people like to take notes. I scribble all over them when I prepare for class. Excuse me. So now Shankara... Sorry. Shankara... Shankara now begins the process of supporting this opening statement, proving this opening statement. He says in the first line, starting at the end, drishtam, anything seen, drishyate, anything capable of being seen, drishyate, being seen, so something that can be seen, which is seen, smarataha, when you remember that object which you saw, like this chair. So right now you see this chair. Suppose you go home and you think about the chair. remember the chair. And Shankara says, that is chitram eva. It is like a chitram, like an image, which is arpitam, applied, drawn, pate, on a piece of cloth. Painting, picture, on a piece of cloth. This was a very common metaphor in ancient times, and perhaps you've seen it before. I think it comes, years ago we studied that Vidyaranya's Panchadashi, and we saw this this metaphor in a wonderful fashion in Panchadashi. It's a metaphor that describes your mind to be like a cloth on which things are drawn or painted. In this case, the cloth represents your mind. What is painted on the cloth represents your experience. So right now, on the so-called cloth of your mind, what is painted is this image, Swami Taratmananda sitting in this chair. If you remember this image, that remembered image is also painted on the cloth of your mind. Anything you experience is like a picture painted on the cloth of your mind. Now, Shankara lived 800 years ago. If Shankara lived today, he would not use this metaphor. He would use a computer screen, a computer monitor, as a metaphor. And your mind is like the screen of a computer on which all of your experiences, or another metaphor he might have used and that I've used quite often, is a movie screen. And this is an even better metaphor, I think. The screen in a movie theater. It's better because it's also pata. It's also cloth. It's also material, like Shankara's example here. So in the movie theater, everything is projected. So just as movies are projected on the screen in the theater, and you sit in the audience watching, observing from a distance. This is such a powerful metaphor. Let's take a few minutes with it. In fact, Shankara in the next couple of verses is going to dissect this in a little bit of a scholarly way. So let's, before we plunge into that, let's get it in a more experiential way. First of all, let's flesh out this metaphor. You are sitting in the seat in the theater, watching the screen. Of course, what happens as you're watching the movie is you forget it's a screen, you forget it's a movie. You get drawn into the plot, drawn into the movie, identified with the character, so it becomes very real. That's what's happening right now. Is it not? Everything happening around you, right now, in this classroom, everything around you is coming to you in the form of impulses on your nervous system. Your eyes convert this image into impulses going through the optic nerve to your brain. Your ears take my voice, turn it into other nerve impulses, which also go to your brain. So, arguably, what you're actually experiencing right now is nerve impulses. But that's so non-intuitive, right? Because we experience whatever is here. And that's the glory, the power of our brains and minds. But that represents sitting in the audience and taking whatever you see projected on the screen as being real. This is common experience. So just as you get identified with what's on the screen in the theater, you take it as being real, in the same way you take this experience as being absolutely real. It's like the movie. Again, nerve impulses. Is that what you're experiencing? Not at all. The reality in the theater is light with form and sound, perhaps, all projected on that screen. The reality right now is nerve impulses. So what we're experiencing right now is not as real as it seems. What is real is the fact that whatever is happening is known to you. Whether it's real or not, it's kind of beside the point. What is unquestionably real is that you're having this experience. Whether it's a bunch of people in a room or whether it's a bunch of nerve impulses, yeah, you can debate that as long as you want. What is undebatable is that you are the observer sitting in that theater experiencing whatever is happening. If you're experiencing light projected on a screen, or if you're experiencing some intense drama, in both cases, you are the experiencer of whatever is taking place. Now, let's finish up with that metaphor. I used to use this metaphor of the double feature movie, but I'm told that no one remembers what double feature movies are. So when I was a kid, it was common that a movie theater would present not just one flick, but two of them. Of course, they weren't 3.5-hour Bollywood things. They were shorter Hollywood flicks. But that's significant in this metaphor because the first, if you watch two different films, it's exactly like projected on the screen of your mind is the waking state and dream state. They're completely different. So each movie, each movie has different actors, different plot, different script, different setting, everything about the movie is different. As different as your dreams are from this waking world. Completely different. I mean, some similarities, but mostly different. So, let's finish this. And this is the part I like so much about this metaphor. You're sitting in the movie theater. You watch the first film. We'll say it's a drama. And then you watch the second film, some kind of horror film. Suppose you have a bad dream, so we'll call it a horror film. And then after the second feature is over, the credits scroll up the screen, and then the screen goes dark. Now, the lights will come on, but there's a few moments before the lights come on in the theater. Consider those few moments. You're sitting in a dark theater, staring at a dark screen. What do you see? Do you see? You haven't gone blind. You see, but there's nothing to be seen. This is an accurate depiction of deep sleep. In deep sleep, you are fully conscious. And most people say, what? Yeah. Can you see in that dark theater? Or just in a more practical sense, go home, stand in a dark closet with the door closed and your eyes wide open. Do you go blind in that dark closet, or can you see? You can see. What do you see? Nothing. You don't lose your power of eyesight in the dark closet, nor do you lose consciousness in deep sleep. So this is not exactly our topic, but it's the metaphor of Shankara uses painting on a cloth, and we've given the movie theater metaphor, very powerful, helpful metaphor to help us understand in a more experiential way. Okay, let us continue. So first half of the verse, he says, whatever you see, actually there are two steps here. Whatever you experience is on the screen of your mind. Whatever you remember is identically on the screen of your mind. What you're seeing right now comes from your eyeballs. What you remember at home comes from your memory. Not much difference. It's similar. Second half. Yatra yena. This is playing tricks with Sanskrit. So Shankara is using this very compact meter. He's only got 8 syllables to work with in a quarter. So you look for tricks. So, and here the trick is yatra, which means where, which refers to the cloth. And yena, by whom, refers to the seer of the cloth. So that's the metaphor he's just given, that you are like one who sees a picture painted on a cloth. So yatra is the cloth, yena is the one who sees, and he says tau, both of those, both the cloth and the seer, ngeyao, should be understood to metaphorically represent sattva and kshetrajna, sanyakau, that which is called, that which is named, sattva and kshetrajna. Now these words are maybe vaguely familiar, but there's a lot going on here. First of all, sattva here doesn't mean sattva guna. Go figure. Words have different meanings in different contexts. Here, sattva means mind. And if you wonder, how can sattva mean mind? Of all the parts that make you up, your mind alone is sattva guna pradhana. It is primarily sattva guna, as opposed to body and other aspects of your being. So sattva in Vedanta is sometimes used to indicate mind. Even Bhagavad Gita, you'll find examples of the word sattva used to mean mind. So sattva means mind. Kshetrajna, you might recognize that word if you've studied chapter 13 of the Bhagavad Gita. The jna, the knower of the kshetra field, the knower of the field of experience. So he's saying in this metaphor, the cloth represents mind, sattva, and the seer of the cloth represents kshetrajna, the knower of the field of experience, the observer, and in this context maybe a little helpful to use the word sakshi, a wareful witness. A wareful witness is like the one who's sitting in the theater. You are witnessing whatever happens on the screen. And this again shows more of the power of this metaphor. When you're sitting in the theater as an awareful witness, does what happened on the screen, does it truly affect you? It seems to affect you, and it affects you emotionally. You get identified with it, but does it really affect you? No, you walk out of the theater, you're the same person that you were when you walked in. It doesn't actually affect you, because look how much distance between you and that screen. Now, that's physical distance. Here we're talking about a metaphorical distance between you, the sakshi, the observer, and mind, the screen of the mind, which is observed. And since we have this not physical different distance, we'll call it conceptual distance. Based on that distance, one does not affect the other. Sitting in the theater, you don't affect the screen, and whatever is on the screen doesn't affect you. In the same way, consciousness doesn't affect what happens in your mind. It reveals what happens in your mind. And similarly, what happens in your mind doesn't affect consciousness. Okay, so this, notice this verse, what has this verse got to do with the fact that you're already Brahman? You see the discontinuity? So, you are already Brahman is the hypothesis, the pratignya. And this is the first verse which is leading up to a very thorough support of that pratignya. Okay, next verse. Palantam chanubhutam yata. Palantam chanubhutam yata. Yuktam kartradi karakaihi. Yuktam kartradi karakaihi. Smaryamanam hi karmastam. Smaryamanam hi karmastam. Purvam karmaiva tachyatah. Purvam karmaiva tachyatah. Shankara assumes that you have studied Sanskrit grammar. He just assumes. You must know everything about Sanskrit grammar. You must know that a verb is connected to six items called karaka. I'm not going to drag you all the way. Like in English, we have a subject and object. So when I say, I see you, there that verb see is connected to a subject, I, and it's connected to an object, you. Tvam aham pashyami. In Sanskrit, I see you. There is a subject, I, and an object, tvam, you. Now, what you need to know, and I'm just going to tell you this before explaining this verse, Sanskrit grammarians call that object, in English we call it direct object, remember learning that, as opposed to an indirect object. So what we call a direct object, the grammarians call karma. That's right. They use that very common word, which has so many other meanings. They use that word karma to mean grammatical object. Shankara presumes you know this, and that's crucial to understanding this verse. Let's see it. So he says, yet, that which palantam, that result, you do some action, and there's a result. So seeing has a result. What is it? You. I see you. You are the result. So that act of seeing is anubhutam, which is experienced. That act of that action, which you receive the results from, you experience that result, and that result you. Dumb is associated with karakaihi. Karaka. Those are the six grammatical things. One of which is karta, agent of action. When I say I see you, I am the subject, the agent of action. So in English we call it subject, in Sanskrit it's called karta, agent or doer. So he says that the action which you perceive the results of which is associated with karakaihi, with these six grammatical, really grammatical parts. Six grammatical parts, kartrari, beginning with karta. Karta, karma, karana. Karana means instrument. There are three more, I'll spare you the details. So he can now, what is a point he wants to make? And that smaryamanam, when you remember what happened to you before. So I see you happens right now. So when you remember, oh, I saw you. So smaryamanam, when you remember that, that memory is karma. That memory is established as a karma, and here karma in a grammatical sense. You see, if you take it as its ordinary meaning, it doesn't work at all. But if you take it in a grammatical sense, whatever you see is seen as an object. Karma here means object. Karmastam. It is established as an object in your mind. That's all he's saying. He uses fairly obscure language, but what he's saying is whatever you experience now is an object in your mind. It's a restatement, partially, of the prior verse. Whatever you experience now is a mental object. You know the word vritti. We use that to describe mental object. Whatever you see, hear, taste, smell, or touch present in your mind as vrittis. Any cognitive thought is present in your mind as a vritti. Any emotion, happiness, sadness, present in your mind as vrittis. All mental activities are vrittis. Those vrittis come at the moment of experience. They become mental objects, vrittis. And then when you remember them, they are still mental objects. Of course, they're not the same as what you they're not identical to your experience. They are remembered, they are recalled, as we said before. Right now, your experience is coming from your five senses. When you remember, it's coming not from your senses, but coming from your memory. Now, he concludes this idea, purvam, previously. This is what I actually jumped the gun, so to speak, on what he's saying here. Purvam, before you remembered, means when you had the experience. At the time of experience, karma eva tachitaha, it was tachitaha for your chittir's consciousness. Chittaha, for your consciousness, for the seer, for you, the sakshi, the awareful observer, the awareful witness, for you, it was karma eva purvam. Previously, it was also a karma. Again, karma in the grammatical sense of object. When you experience something, it is a karma, object. When you remember something, it is a... Let's drop the grammatical language. It's confusing. When you experience something, it is projected on the screen of your mind as a vritti. When you remember something, projected on the screen of your mind as a vritti. This leads to the next verse. We'll just see one more before we conclude. drashtushyan, drashtushchan yat bhavet drishyam, drashtushchan yat bhavet drishyam, drishyat twad ghatavat sada, drishyat twad ghatavat sada, drishyat, drishyat drashta sajatiyo nadhivat sakshitanyatha. And this concludes this line of thought, making this extremely clear. Subject-object relationship. Vedanta really begins with this observation that you are the conscious observer, the sakshi of whatever is projected on the screen of your mind. This is where Vedanta begins. So he explains this in very simple, direct terms, which is a little unusual for Shankara to use simple, direct terms, but this verse is such. So he says, drashtuhu, for the seer, for you, the awareful witness, the sakshi. Drashtuhu anyat. We have to put those words together. Other than the seer, other than the observer, bhavet drishyam is what is observed. The observed, drishtam, is other than the observer. Now, that seems so obvious. The observer is different from the observed. If that seems so obvious, then please tell me why, if you see your body, and I see this body, and it happens to be a male body. If I say, I am male, what's going on? The body is male, not the seer. The point I'm making is that object is separate from subject, seer is different from seen, observer is different from observed. Your response will be, well, the American expression, pardon me, is, well, duh. I think for some of our foreign students, that might sound a little interesting, but that's a common American expression. It means, well, of course. So, but it's not of course. We make mistakes about this all the time. The characteristics of the observed get superimposed on the observer. For example, the skin is white. So I say, I'm white. But that's conventional, right? This paper is white, therefore I am white. Huh? This recorder is black. I see this recorder, therefore I am black. Seriously, this is how confused we are until Vedanta removes that confusion. This discernment between knower and known, observer and observed, is crucial. It may on the surface seem unremarkable. Observer is different from observed, but on examination, it is at the crux of our confusion. It's the locus of confusion. Our inability to discern. Observed is utter. Observer is utterly separate and independent of the observed. And Shankara gives the famous example, drishyatvad gatavat sada. It is always like that. Why? Because gatavat, like a pot, like a pot. It is drishyatva because of being observed like a pot. So I observe this pot, therefore I am different from the pot, I am separate from the pot. Again, I look at the pot is small, therefore I am small. How silly is that? The pot is red, I am red. But those are exactly the mistakes we make. Sadness and happiness take place in your mind and are known to you as mental objects. Like the pot is in your mind, known to you as a mental object. You know the pot in your mind as a mental object. Would you say, I am a pot? Pot is present in your mind as a mental object. None of you would say, I am a pot. Happiness or sadness are present in your mind as mental objects. And you say, I am happy, I am sad. This is the locus of confusion. And then he concludes here with a little bit of important logic. Drishyatvat drashta asajatiyaha. Back to using his technical language. He says, because the drashta, the observer, the seer, is asajatiyaha, utterly different drishyatvat than what is seen. Because the seer is utterly different from what is seen. The seer has a special quality that is absent in the seen. And a good metaphor for that is this. Lights shine. Other objects don't shine. Any object that emits light has a special quality, a quality that's not shared by objects that merely reflect light. So this is what we call asajatiya, utterly different, not of the same category, not of the same nature. So just as objects that emit light are categorically different from objects that reflect light, in the same way, you, consciousness, the seer, is categorically different from the seen. So this is a nice metaphor. That which emits light is categorically different from that which reflects light. The seer is categorically different from the scene. And he says, in the last line, anyata, otherwise, na sakshita, otherwise the seer would not be the witness, divat, like the mind. The mind is witnessed, the mind is not the witness. Again, a little technical, but we'll go back to that light metaphor. Suppose, in the third line, Shankara said that the seer is categorically different from the seen, like that which emits light is categorically different from that which doesn't. So, suppose they weren't categorically different. Suppose that the light didn't emit light and was identical to that which only reflected light, then how could light cannot illumine the objects unless it has that quality of radiating light? And this is the metaphor to understand the uniqueness of consciousness. Consciousness is that which reveals all activities in your mind, all vrittis, which means every experience you've ever had or ever will have, all of those experiences are revealed by consciousness. All of those experiences take place when they are projected on the screen of your mind. And what we have to see, as we continue now, is we have to discover how it is that the seen doesn't affect the seer. This light shines on me. I'm orange. My clothes are orange. We have to use language properly here. Tell me, does this orangeness affect the light? Not at all. And that's what we will see in the coming verses, how the vrittis in your mind, like happiness and sadness, don't affect the consciousness, which is your true nature, the consciousness which illumines that happiness and sadness. Okay, a good place to conclude. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om tat sat.